Thank you, Maharaj. Catching Maharaj's time is very difficult. Maharaj, these are very bright students from one of the best universities in the world, Hong Kong University of Science and Technology in Hong Kong. Personally, Sumitra and I have had the pleasure of being there two or three times. And it's now rated as the top university in Asia and one of the best in the world, I think. And they come from different backgrounds and get exposure from all over the world. I took the opportunity to introduce you before you came, but we are all big fans, devotees of Maharaj, and I would encourage you to read his autobiography, A Journey Home, and that is strange. He's a person of Jewish origin from America, from Chicago, and his journey home was right here to India. And his entire experiences along the way, meeting masters of different spiritual traditions, genuine masters of genuine spiritual traditions. And when he pursued his own path, while he pursues his own path of devotion and bhakti, his respect and regard for all the other paths is second to none. And while he encourages us to seek divinity around us and within us, he also inspires us to serve humanity. So it is seeking divinity and serving humanity and acting in compassion that allows him to meet lots of people and inspire them to develop a greater meaning and purpose in life. I hope the interaction, I'm certain the interaction today will inform you and transform you. If you allow a disciple, a student learns knowledge. I'm told, a disciple allows the teaching to transform him. So today you can decide to be students or allow the teaching to actually penetrate you. Maharaj is now also addresses the House of Commons, the House of Lords in the UK, various institutions like HSBC, Google, Starbucks, TED, YPO. He meets Obama when Maharaj goes to US. When Obama comes to India, again Maharaj meets him. He meets prime ministers, presidents. But he is so grounded in what he says that every time I meet him, I think of him, or I read his works, it is a new inspiration. Maharaj, these are students from Hong Kong, and you can give some time, if you have the time, for some question answers later.
Very honored to have this opportunity to be with all of you today. Special gratitude to Vivek and to Dr. Mitra, and to Mitya, Loretta, Michelle, to each and every one of you. How many of you is it your first trip to India? How many have been here before? May I tell you about my first trip to India? I actually wrote a book about it. But I was born in Chicago, in the United States, 1950. And when I was a teenager, it was the 1960s. And for those of you who have studied something about the sociological history of America, that was a very turbulent time. Because our parents, many of them, were brought up in the Great Depression, where literally the American economy practically totally collapsed. There was massive poverty. My father had to leave school when he was about 14 to work full-time just to help his parents to give the simplest food to the family. But then, the 1940s, there was World War II. And after that, America's economy really started to flourish. And people, many, became very wealthy. My own father was working very hard, and he got some nice wealth. So it was a booming time. But the youth at that time formed what was called the counterculture, which means millions of young people in their teens and 20s rejected the whole society, the whole establishment that their parents stood for. And they left home to search for something with more meaning. And many were looking for it in drugs, and many looking for it in music, and many looking for it in sex, and some in spirituality also. You see, at the time, I know in my own life, my father went bankrupt when I was about 9. So when I was about 14, 15, I got a job while going to school. And everyone I worked with were African American. They were a minority. And in those days, if you were African American, 98% you would be born in a ghetto, you would live and you would die in the ghetto. Constitutionally, there was civil rights for everyone. But socially, there was practically none. It didn't make sense to me. The prejudices, the inequality. So I joined the civil rights movement of Martin Luther King. At the same time, there was a war in Vietnam. And many of the young people really didn't believe we should be there. We felt we had no real business there. It wasn't based on truths. It was based on political manipulations. So there were demonstrations against the Vietnam War. And I joined that too. And I got tear gassed by the police. And I was chased with clubs, and my friends were put in prison. It was a turbulent time. And at that time we were thinking, yes, people may have a lot of money, and people may have a lot of power and prestige, but there must be something deeper and more in life than that. So people like me started questioning everything. So myself and one of my friends decided to take a summer trip between college semesters to Europe, just to see how other people from other countries, from other religions, how they view the values of life. What is their conception of America and of God? So we went, and it's a long story, but we had no money, and we were meeting people. And as my life progressed more and more, I really felt whatever I do in my life, whether it's helping my father's business or going into science or going into engineering or art, unless I found a spiritual foundation within myself, I didn't really see that I could be meaningful to the world. But at the same time, I saw so much hatred and violence and prejudice in the name of religion. And it's been there throughout history. So do I just reject religion altogether? I often thought of that. But then my heart just wouldn't allow me to do it, nor would my intellect. I believed there must be essential values, essential common principles and goals that are at the core of every religion. And the fighting is about superficial external things. And if we don't understand the core essence, then we think those external superficial things are the essence. So I wanted to find that unity within the diversity that I was seeing in spirituality, sociology, and in the world altogether. So I went on a spiritual search. I studied deeper my own religion. I was born into Judaism. I was going to Christian monasteries and studying there in cathedrals. And on a mountaintop in Greece, while I was praying for direction, I heard a voice in my own heart. It was a loud voice that couldn't be heard anywhere outside of me. And it said, go to India. So I hitchhiked from Greece to India through Turkey, Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan. Took about 6 months. And I studied Islam from a scholar of the Quran in Iran. And observed the people. And I found in all these traditions so much beauty, and at the same time so much possibility of extremism everywhere. And finally I reached India. Why was India so special for me? And why so many millions of people from all parts of the world come to India for spiritual enlightenment? Because many people are looking for a very universal principle of spirituality. And the heritage of India has a very deep legacy in that spirit. The country, with all of its problems, has a very unique and special quality within this world. From a spiritual perspective, the largest population of Hindus in the world is in India. Krishna was born in Mathura and spoke Bhagavad Gita in Kurukshetra. Ram was born in Ayodhya, and Valmiki Muni wrote his legacy, the Ramayana, while living here in India. Also, it has, even today, the largest population of Sikhs. Guru Nanak, who was the founder of the Sikh religion, from India. India has the largest population of Jains. Mahavir, the founder of this religion, was also from Bihar in India. Buddha, one of the fastest growing religions of the world today, has its holiest of all holy places in India. Buddha was born in Lumbini and attained enlightenment in Bodh Gaya. I believe outside of Iran, India has the largest population of Parsis or Zoroastrians. They found refuge here when they were being persecuted. India has one of the oldest Jewish communities in the entire planet Earth, and also one of the oldest Christian communities. In Christianity, one of the direct disciples of Jesus was Saint Thomas. And just after Jesus Christ departed from this mortal world, Saint Thomas came to India, to Kerala, to what is now Chennai, and established Christianity. And it's been thriving ever since, 2,000 years. India also has the second largest Muslim population in the whole world. So it's interesting how many various religions from all over this planet has found refuge and flourished in this land of India. Because of the foundational universal principles of the spirituality of this nation. It's called Sanatana Dharma. Spiritual principles that help us to understand who we truly are. What is our true relationship with each other, with the environment, with God, with the world. And these universal principles, when understood deeply, actually include all other true religions. In one sense, it's all part of Sanatana Dharma. There's no need for sectarianism. There's actually not just a respect of live and let live, not just the mutual respect of making an alliance so that we don't kill each other, which is usually what we have to do. But at the core of the teachings and the heritage is an understanding that we're ultimately all of the same spiritual path, just different rooms in the same house. And we could actually respect and honor and appreciate. And because this principle has been found in the teachings of the great spiritual masters of India, people from all over the world have come here to look for that, to find that. The Bhagavad Gita, which is one of the foundational scriptures that have been here, you know, for millenniums in India, when I found one particular teaching there, one verse out of 700, in my own life, I thought, this is really what I'm looking for. Can I tell you the verse? Vidya vinaya sampane brahmani gavihastini suni chaiva svapakecha pandita samadarshana. The English translation. Enlightened person, their quality is that they see every living being with equal vision. Whether one is a high priest, or whether one is living in the streets, or whether one is an elephant, or a cow, or a dog, wherever there's life, it is sacred. Aham bija pratapita. In the Gita, who we believe is the one God of all living beings who have come to this world in many times, in many ways, with many names, spoke the Gita as Krishna. And he explained that every living being is a child of the same source, the same God. We are all brothers and sisters. And the beginning of actually realizing this beyond just a theoretical conception is to ask the simple question, who am I? Because unless we understand who I am, I can't never understand who anybody else really is. And the Gita tells that the living force within us is spiritual. It is Satchidananda. It is eternal, full of knowledge, full of bliss. And that living force is who is seeing through the eyes and hearing through the ears and tasting through the tongue, thinking through the brain, loving through the heart. The body and mind are like an automobile, but the Atma, or the soul, the self, is like the driver. And to, when we understand who we truly are as an eternal, beautiful, godly being, then we can also recognize how wherever there's life, there is that spirit. All beings are our brothers and sisters. And whatever wealth we have, whatever knowledge we have, whatever strength we have, whatever influence we have, we are not the proprietors. We are the caretakers. These are gifts. After all, without the air we cannot breathe, without the sunshine we cannot see, without the rains we have no nourishment. There are higher powers that are providing for us in every way. And according to theistic traditions, that higher power is Bhagavan, or God, or Krishna, many names. And these are gifts. The knowledge that we all acquire in our universities, through our studies, the wealth we may obtain through our hard work or inheritance, the influence we have over other people due to our positions, if we think this is mine, the tendency is to become very arrogant. I am better than you. Or if somebody else has more than us, the tendency is to become envious or depressed. But if we understand this concept that I am the caretaker, and whatever gifts we have, we're grateful to have them. And when we understand the true nature of our heart, our soul, then we know that sharing what we have, whatever it may be, for the welfare of others, social, spiritual, physical, emotional, that's where my real happiness is. That's where my real pleasure is. Because there's no higher pleasure to the heart than to love and be loved. And when we connect to the love that's within us, which is our true potential, then in whatever we do, we become instruments of compassion. That's the greatest need of the world. To live in a spirit of compassion is the only thing that can actually satisfy the heart. An elevated society is where people love people and use things to express their love. But if we forget that principle, then what often happens is we love things and we use people to get those things and keep those things. I heard a very beautiful statement that you can tell how wealthy you are by counting how many things you have that money cannot buy. When we hear this, we have to question, what is real wealth? Real wealth is the fulfillment and the happiness that is within us. Once I saw a little girl. Her parents were extremely wealthy. And they both worked really hard all day. But they had no time for their daughter. So when I saw her, she was dressed really pretty. But she lived in misery. Because a beautiful dress wasn't what's going to make her happy. She wanted the love of her parents. But they didn't have time for her. Because they were too busy. The heart is yearning to love and be loved. And real wealth is to have that love, to find that peace, to find that meaningfulness in our life. Whether we're billionaires or millionaires or upper class or middle class, or whether we're penniless little swamis like me, those are all details. Our real wealth is the satisfaction that we found within ourselves. Gita teaches true intelligence is to find one's enlightenment and satisfaction within ourselves. And some people throughout the ages have said, if you become spiritually content, then you're not going to be able to be active and competitive within the world around us. But that's actually not necessarily true, because love is the most powerful motivator. Compassion is even a greater motivator. The Bhagavad Gita was spoken on a battlefield. Whether we have families or whether we're monks. A mother, because of her love for her baby, she's not complacent. She'll serve her child 24 hours a day without expecting anything in return. She just, because she loves. So similarly, when we find that love within ourselves, which comes through associating with people who inspire us in this way, inspire us in these values, and having a spiritual practice to actually make that connection and sustain that connection. And then living in a spirit of seva, a spirit where here in Mumbai we have people who are CEOs of major, major international corporations, and they work extremely hard. But the foundation is their love and compassion, not their arrogance or their greed. And they excel over so many others because their motivating reason is so deep and so beautiful. So this is basically the foundational principles that are so visible when we study the spiritual heritage of India. And it is these principles that have attracted people from all over the world to come to make that connection. Some people, they don't like religion, but they want a spiritual connection, so they come to study yoga. But interestingly, because I was kind of like that, I learned, what does yoga mean? Yoga is the Sanskrit word. It means to reunite. To reunite our consciousness with our atma, with our soul. And when we make that connection, we reunite with God. We reunite with the sacred principle of life within all beings and within nature around us. It's reunion. And all the different aspects of yoga are meant to gradually bring us to that enlightened state. And then I learned that the Latin word religio is where religion comes from. And the meaning of that word is to bring one back, to bind one back. Religion and yoga mean exactly the same thing. Neither one of them indicate anything sectarian in their origin. It means to reconnect with our true essence. And in doing so, to reconnect with the environment and the people and all beings and God. And to live with that principle. Sometimes I go to Rishikesh. And it's really interesting because I first went to Rishikesh in 1970 when I arrived in India. I was 19 years old then. And I was living in a cave in the jungles and I was kind of all alone. But now when I come to Rishikesh, my God, so many people from everywhere. In fact, I see menus in restaurants in Hindi, in Chinese, in Hebrew, in German, in Italian. People from everywhere are coming. Vrindavan, a holy place. I was just in Vrindavan, Mayapur, and there were people from almost every country seeking enlightenment, seeking that universal, essential spiritual principle. And now that India is becoming very prominent economically within the world, it's something really important for the people of India and the people of the world to understand the beautiful wealth of the inherent culture of this land. And I'm so grateful that you have all come. I'm going to tell one little story more. My father, he's 91 years old now. I just talked to him a few days ago on telephone. And he told me, he said he watches the news on television. He said, so much bad news. He said, he went in detail, which I don't have to share with you because you know. So much bad news in America and in the Middle East and in different European countries and in Africa and in Russia and Ukraine and so many places and in Southeast Asia. But he said, the only good news is India. He said, first time in my life, he said, I'm seeing that the most brightest place in the world now is India. I've been here more or less since 1970, that's 45 years. He said, for the first time, I really am happy you're there and I feel you're safe. So the reason I'm telling you this is on all levels, people are really recognizing the potential of India in so many ways. And people like Vivek, he's an investor and a banker and an educator, but such deep, beautiful, universal spiritual values. And so many people here that I see that really are like that. And that's something that's really the true beauty of India. And my sincere hope and my prayer is, along with understanding the politics of India and the economic possibilities in India and how things work and how people think here in India, is to try to actually understand and bring home with you an appreciation for the underlying spiritual values that are here in India. There's a saying, if you lose your wealth, you lose nothing. If you lose your health, you lose something. If you lose your character, you lose everything. Thank you very much. I don't know if that's what I was supposed to talk about, but I think it is. Would anyone like to ask any questions or speak any realizations? I'll be really honored to answer any questions. Please.
I would like to know, like, why Krishna? I know that there are many gods in here, but why Krishna?
Arivo, that's such a nice question. In the Bhagavad Gita, there is a beautiful verse. Yada yada hi dharmasya glanir bhavati bharata abhyutanam dharmasya tadatmanam srijamyaham. Now, this verse impacted me a lot because I found people of various religions who were deeply loving, kind people with very high character of all religions. But I myself was from a minority religion. And many people, even in America, hated me because of it. And they accused me of things that happened thousands of years ago. And this verse is very beautiful because it explains that the one God, the one truth, has descended into this world over the ages, in many forms, with many names, but always for the same purpose, to remind us what we've forgotten, our own deep, true spiritual nature. And when we connect to that nature, we're transformed. Arrogance is transformed into humility. Greed into generosity, lust into love, complacency into compassion, misery into true happiness. It's that transformation that the Lord teaches us when He comes into this world. So in this way, this verse teaches a very inclusive conception. And that one truth, the source of everything that exists, who people call God, people call Allah, people call Jehovah, people call Ram, name Krishna is very prominent within the Vedas or the scriptures and within the history of this country. Krishna appeared about 5,000 years ago and spoke the Gita and performed beautiful pastimes of love. And the name Krishna in Sanskrit means all attractive. I remember one time a fundamentalist of another religion was really attacking me, saying I was going to go to hell. And I said, why? He said, you're going to hell. And I said, well, where are you going? He said, I'm going to heaven. And I said, well, if you're going to heaven, I think I'll be happier in hell. because if heaven is filled of hateful people like you, I don't think I want to be there eternally. And I said, why do you say I'm going to hell? He said, because you worship a false god. I said, well, how do you know? Because Krishna is a false god. I said, can I ask you a question? Is your god supremely beautiful? He said, yes. Is he the source and proprietor of everything? He said, yes. Does he know everything? He said, yes. I said, so having these qualities, is he all attractive? He said, yes. I said, well, Krishna means all attractive. It's the name of your god. Why do you not like to call him all attractive? So, in my heart, and the hearts of hundreds of millions of people in India, either because of their forefathers and mothers, or because of just the inspiration of their heart, like myself, we just found such beauty and sweetness and philosophical meaning in the path that has been given in Bhagavad Gita, spoken by Krishna. Does that answer your question? Thank you. Yes.
I have a question as well.
Please.
So, I very much like the values you talked about.
Can you put the microphone a little closer?
Yes, of course. And I've heard that in Hinduism, you can find yourself also through meditation. And together with the values you've talked about, if more people would take this path, then the peace in the world would be much greater and there would be less war and everything would be much more peaceful. And people believe in science. So why don't you use the track of science to prove that these values and that these ways are working?
That's brilliant.
Thank you.
Science and technology are potentially for great benefit of humanity and all beings, or potentially they could be for great devastation. It depends on the character and the hearts of the people who use it. I'll give a simple example. A knife. One person who has that knife will kill someone, cut their throat, and take everything they have away from them. So when the knife is in the hands of a thief, it's destructive. But the same exact knife, if it's in the hands of a surgeon, it will save a person's life with compassion. So is the knife good or bad? The knife is as bad as the person who holds it, or as good as the person who holds it? And that's the way everything in this world is. Knowledge, fame, strength, and science and technology are a tremendous strength. But we could use that science and technology out of greed. And we can actually pollute the environment and cause so much suffering to so many living beings, including humanity, through our science and technology. Or we could use it to create great health and prosperity and enlightenment, as you're saying. So science and technology, especially when it is harmonized with these universal spiritual principles and character, can have such great value within the world. And the students who are going to universities and learning technology and learning science, the destiny of the world is very much in all of your hands. And it's going to be determined by the values and the character and the spirit of compassion that you've actually imbibed within your hearts. Whether we want to be a part of the problem or a part of a wonderful holistic solution. So the practices of meditation, the practices of chanting God's names or mantras, puja, seva, these are all ways of reconnecting to that deep, enlightened state that is within us, that is our true potential. And there have been many medical, scientific research of how meditation actually affects in a very positive way the brain, the cells of the body. Even though it's a great, very detailed about this chanting of the Hare Krishna mantra, how it affects in such a positive way the cells and the brain and the whole way we think in a very positive way. So science is beautiful if we are beautiful. And science could be very ugly if we're ugly. So this holistic form of education is along with the tools to discover and accomplish great things in this world. We should also educate ourselves in how we could actually make those inner connections and share them and live with character, live with values, live with gratitude, live with humility. Humility doesn't make us cowards. Humility means we're recognizing that there's a higher power beyond my own that I humble myself and harmonize myself for. And that could make us very, very enthusiastic, determined, and courageous, fearless. But not in a mood to exploit, in a mood to serve. There's three principles that are very core to the Indian spiritual traditions, especially from the Gita. One is satsang. Satsang means whatever we're doing in life, we should regularly be in the company of people who really inspire us and enlighten us toward the importance of spirituality and character so we don't get distracted. Because actually, in this world, we are always being bombarded by weapons of mass distraction. So many distractions. And if we have a strong spiritual foundation, then even when the storms come, our integrity is preserved. So satsang is important. Being regularly in that company of people that really do inspire us and educate us in these higher values. And the second is sadhana, our own spiritual practice, to give some time every day, as far as possible, to actually make that inner connection. You see, when you water the root of a tree, the water naturally extends to every part of the tree. The branches, the twigs, the flowers, and the leaves. So similarly, when we make that connection to God within ourselves, in our own essence, then we find in that love, it extends to everyone, wherever there's life. That comes through sadhana, or spiritual practice. Tuning in to the grace that is within us. And of course, it's important that we tune in regularly, because otherwise there's so many other frequencies that can capture our attention. And meditation, kirtan, the core of yoga practice is really tuning in like that. And the third principle is sadachar. That means living with character, living with compassionate values, seva. That means embracing within our heart that there is no greater thing in all of creation than the opportunity to serve with love. That is character. In its deepest sense. And when we make those connections in whatever religion we're in, or whatever social position we may be in, then the science and the technologies we learn can be instruments, just like our own body and mind could be beautiful instruments to heal in a spirit of compassion. Does that address what... Well, you didn't ask a question. You just said something very nice, and I'm giving my own way of agreeing with you. Thank you. Excuse me? Been very high-level research projects in this regard. There was one professor from the United States who spent most of his life doing scientific, verifiable research about the proof of reincarnation. He traveled so many parts of the world. And even the greatest scientist said that whatever he said is completely a verification according to modern science. Whether they believed it or not is another thing. So, you know, these things are there. And what you're saying is very beautiful, that the more there is this type of research, the more it could actually give inspiration and hope to people in that sense. And really it should be pursued more and more. At the same time, with material science, tangible evidence can only give us a glimpse of symptoms of something that's actually beyond the range of the senses. I'll give an example. A thought. Can you see a thought or taste a thought or hear a thought with your ears? Can you smell a thought? And little, you know, you could have brain waves, but can the brain wave tell you what the thought is? So thoughts are invisible, and they can't be necessarily directly verifiable through scientific instruments. But a single little thought could rule over a person's life more than all the things of this world. A thought. You know, when dictators invade countries and drop bombs and all of those things, the origin of is a thought in their mind, right? So we can understand the symptom. This person, by what we see outside, we can understand this person's really not thinking very good. But the thought itself is so subtle that it can't really be grasped. And that psychology is a subtle science. But there's also a spiritual science. Just like there's physical science, there's psychological subtle sciences, and there's also spiritual sciences. And when we recognize these three sciences, and we actually begin to harmonize them and respect them, then we can actually see how they're all interconnected with each other. Because if I'm feeling bliss in my heart, it's hard to find that in scientific research. But how it's expressed, how it's manifested, can be seen. I'm smiling, I'm laughing, I'm sharing it with others. It's very tangible in its intent, but the core of it, the origin of it, is very intangible. It's the most tangible thing to our experience in life, but it's intangible in its essence to physical researches. Does that make sense?
So why is there not one research being done if this is really tangible, where, for example, there's a drawing on the forehead and the person can see the drawing? Why do people say they see themselves but they never measure it?
Some people try to measure, but it's not so easy. But yes, the harmony of science and spirituality is very much the hope for the world. Thank you. Yes.
Hi, my name is Kim. Thank you very much for inspirational speech. As you mentioned, actually all things should be equal, but in reality there are actually a lot of inequalities and injustice around the world. Sometimes people want to make a change or to help, but they would always have a mentality that actually the existence of human, of an individual, is so small, and the impact that they can bring to the world is actually so small, and they ended up doing nothing to help or to make a change. So from your perspective, what should be the right attitude or mentality for those people who really want to help to make a change to these inequalities and injustices?
Thank you. It's beautiful. In the world we live today, we are very much almost indoctrinated to value quantity over quality. Yes? You know, how big, how much. But the heart actually values quality, not necessarily quantity. There's a simple analogy, and then I will explain it. In the Ramayana, one of the great scriptures of India, there was a bridge being built across the ocean with rocks. And Hanuman, who was an extremely powerful, incredible warrior, who had such deep love for God, or Ram, he was bringing gigantic rocks from the mountains that weighed tons to build the ocean. And his beloved Lord, Ram, who was an avatar, who was walking behind him, happened to see Hanuman stop because there was a little squirrel. And the squirrel jumped in the water, then rolled around in sand, and then went just shook his body and made the little grains of sand go on the bridge. And Hanuman didn't want to step on the squirrel while he's holding, so he told the squirrel, please move. And Ram said, that squirrel is doing as much as you. Because you're doing your capacity to help. And that little squirrel is doing his capacity to help, or her capacity. I don't really know whether it was a boy or girl squirrel. Let's suppose it was a girl. She's doing her capacity. So for me, it's equal. I don't see the result. I see the intent. And many of the greatest things that happen in the world begin really small. But if we just think, I'm so small, I can't make a difference, then we won't make a difference. But if we can even help one person in our life, that is a tremendous accomplishment. That's greater than winning the World Cup or being a world champion. If you can help one person in this world, that's a great thing. What to speak of two or three or a million? The quality is really important. And we could all make a difference, big or small. There's a house just about a 10-minute drive from here when there's no traffic. And I go there sometimes to give talks. It's a very old house. It's a beautiful mansion. And there's a living room in this house. And the living room is exactly as it was in the 1940s. The same carpet, the same sofas and chairs, the same coverings on the sofas and chairs, and everything is exactly in the same place it was in the 1940s. Because what happened there is that's where Mahatma Gandhi and Sardarji Patel and Nehru and a few others, there were just about five of them, they would meet in that house to discuss liberating India from the British rule. None of them had any money, hardly anything. None of them had armies. It was just a few people with common thoughts. And that's where they decided to establish this cause called Quit India. At that time, it is said the British Empire, the sun never set. The United Kingdom ruled over India for almost two centuries. And a few people just discussed with themselves, let's get the British out. And they did. That's where it began. Then they started spreading the word. But at the beginning, you know, as soon as they started spreading the word, they were put in jail. But they didn't give up. So many of the greatest things that have happened in world history start with little people. Yes, in America, Thomas Edison. So much of the concept of electricity and lighting, you know, in a little place, like Ohio or New Jersey or something like that. He was just his little laboratory all alone, and all of his experiments kept failing. And one journalist asked him, you know, you failed in this experiment 800 times. Don't you get discouraged? He said, no, every time I fail, I get encouraged. Because now I know 800 ways it doesn't work. That means I'm closer to figuring out how it does work. He was just sitting in his little laboratory. But he had a purpose. And he believed in it. And now see how it has affected the planet. So little thing, big things often start with little people in little ways. And it really isn't, what's important is not so much the result, but it's our purpose, our cause. And even if we could just do a little something for just a few people, in God's eyes, and in the soul, in our own conscience eyes, that is a gigantic accomplishment. And if we could do something with great quantity, same thing. Every single one of us can make an incredibly beautiful difference in the world we live. And that's what gives the life meaning. When we see so much terrorism and so much hatred and so much greed and so much, you know, earthquakes and volcanoes and droughts and so many problems in the world, sometimes we think, what am I going to do? But we can do something incredible and unbelievable. Just by making that inner connection and making the right choices to make a positive difference. And when a few of us come together to share that, like they did in that little house that big house I was telling you about, then wonderful things really can happen. So failing in life is when we don't see that potential. And real success in life is not the quantity, but what we live for. Does that answer your question? Thank you. Did you already, anyone else? Yes, please.
I have a question, it's more about India, because as you mentioned, it's a spirituality is very high and very religious country. But for us who come from other country, actually it's our first day here. Actually, it's quite a shock to see such a disparity in this country. So I just wonder how you can explain this.
Yeah, it's true. It's very true. India has, you know, was subjugated by the foreign mogul powers for about 700 years, by the British powers for about 200 years. So it just got its independence, 70 years ago or something? Huh? Something like that. August 15th. 1947. So, you know, it's gone through so much. And considering, you know, the population, considering the exploitation that has come from foreign powers for so long, considering the poverty, unbelievable poverty, the disease. When I first came to India in 1970, it wasn't as crowded. I think there was about 600 million people when I came here. Now there's over 1 billion people. So it's about doubled in size in the same amount of land. But I had never seen, Afghanistan was very poor when I passed through, but India, the poverty and the amount of diseases and the amount of, you know, how to explain it, very dysfunctional bureaucracy and political corruption that has been for so long in this country. It's like, you know, what's spiritual about all that? And it's true, those things are very much there. But underlying it, in the heart of the actual tradition of India, and in the hearts of so many of the people of India who have actually, you know, preserved that connection of all religions, it's something so deep and so beautiful and so life-changing. And over the years, I've seen so many people from foreign countries come to India. And usually, what I find is by the time they leave India, they really hate this place. Because, you know, women getting raped and this and that and all, you know, on the external feature, there's so much disparity in India. So they either leave thinking, God, and they get dysentery. They leave either kind of traumatized, or despite all the things that I just talked about, they leave transformed and enlightened, because something that's almost invisible here is so deep and so rich and so beautiful. I see it all the time. People come from China, from America, from Europe, from Australia, from South America, from Africa. And so many, they don't leave the same. Something has changed in their heart that's very beautiful. It's given them wisdom, given them intuition. And it says in the Bible, seek and you shall find. So depending on what we're seeking, we're going to find that. There's a lot of inequality. There's the caste system. There's so many things that are very, very wrong in this country. But below the surface, there's some of the most beautiful people and such beautiful wisdom and such a beautiful culture. And all these really wrong things are due to distractions from that. Does that kind of answer your question? A lot of times, people just flying into Bombay, if they don't have a night flight where they don't get to see what's happening when they're landing, if they have a day flight, as you're coming in, there's ghettos all around the airport that make the ghettos in America seem like very, very middle class, nice places. Maybe not in what's going on in them, but as far as the physical standard of living. And oftentimes it shocks people. And then when they get out of the airport and they get in their car and beggars come, sometimes with leprosy, sometimes with deformed and begging for money. And I remember my mother came to India and she had some candy in her purse and she gave them to one of these people, and suddenly there was about 50 of them around. And she was horrified. What to speak of when she got attacked by a monkey. But still, when she left, she said, I met the finest people I've ever met in my life. Their lives were changed. So please, while you're here, you know, let's try to make a difference on the level that is really sad with whatever we can do. But to actually go, you know, deeper than that, to that substance, beautiful substance, that has always been in India despite all of these problems, that great thinkers and philosophers and saintly people have come to India to be enriched by and nourished by. And even in London, I meet sometimes recently some European bankers and investors who are really powerful. And they have told me, so many like that, that I had an assignment in India and I was horrified when I got there. But by the time I came back home, India was like my mother, because they went beneath the surface into something that was really very valuable. And I'll end the answer to this question with one little thing. My guru, Srila Prabhupada, he was in London in 1969. And a journalist, he said, "We have our own religion and our own society. You're a Hindu Swami. Why have you come to England?" And he said that you British people, you ruled over India for almost two centuries. And while you did it, you very much exploited practically all the wealth you could from India to bring to England. You know, jewels and so many facilities and minerals and... said you took from India practically all the treasures you could get and brought to him. Said, but you forgot to take the most valuable treasure of India, its culture, its deep spiritual traditions. You forgot to take that. And I have come to England give you for free what you forgot to take from India. Is there any other? Yes, please.
How do you consider yourself?
I consider myself very fortunate and happy to be with you. Can you be a little more...
like in terms of, do you consider yourself a monk? Or do you consider yourself like a particular enlightened spiritual guide? How do you consider yourself in terms of your mission in this life?
That's the hardest question anyone's asked. A Swami is a monk. So that's the role and the service that I've taken in my life. The concept of a Swami or a monk in our tradition is we accept a vow of celibacy, and we accept where we don't have any property or really anything that is our own as far as material things. And the idea is that in order to give our whole energy to the whole world according to our capacity, we give up the responsibility of a small family so that we can put our whole energy into trying to serve the whole human family, the whole family of all beings, to our capacity. So the idea of renunciation is for the purpose of seva, or service. Now, you can do the same service practically living in a family But in our tradition, we have in this temple probably a congregation of about 10,000. And there's one Swami who lives here. And there's maybe about 200 monks. So the monks and the Swami, you know, we encourage and inspire the congregation. And in that way, the congregation is doing so much to help us, and we're doing so much to help them. And the combination is something very beautiful. Those who are in the renounced life help to just keep the family people focused. So in this way, that's a service. So my role is as a Swami. The spiritual path that I follow is bhakti, or the path of devotion, specifically Krishna devotion. But how do I consider myself? I consider myself just very grateful that I've been given the opportunity to dedicate my life to service. And I find no greater pleasure, no greater wealth than the opportunity to serve, to really try to make some difference in other people's lives, especially in a spiritual way. So I just like to be the servant of the servant of the servant of all other servants, in whatever role I may be in. And that may be an esoteric answer, but that's how I see myself. Yes.
Personally, I was raised religious Catholic in my family. As I've grown older and become more informed, I'd say that I've acquired a lot of the values that you've talked about, but I've become a lot less religious. My question is, you've equated spirituality with religion a lot. Do you think that people can be spiritual and have all these values that you've discussed, but not be religious at all?
It depends on our definition of spirituality and religion. I would say values is required to actually be genuine in any spiritual path or religious path. In the yoga system, there's the yamas and the niyamas, which is basically on our values, on our ethics, on our morality, because we can't truly build on our spiritual experience unless we have those values. And oftentimes, people like me, and perhaps it's what you're talking about too, when we see religions, which are supposed to be spiritual, or spirituality, which may be a religion, when we don't see those values, we often turn away from spirituality or religion, whatever we may call it. So those values are necessary. The universal character of anyone on any religious or spiritual path who really are doing it right in a meaningful, deep way is they're going to have common character and values that are universal. Compassion, honesty, self-control, generosity, wisdom, insight. These are qualities, whether one is a Christian or a Muslim or a Jew or a Hindu or whatever, These are the common values we find in the scriptures and in the lives of the saints, the realized people. And a saint could be a mother with three children, or a saint could be a monk who's, you know, traveling around and preaching. But without a concept of our actual spiritual identity beyond birth and death, without a path that brings us to that internal ecstatic love, love for God and all beings that's within us, then the values we live by without that connection don't bring us to the same depth beyond birth and death as a deep spiritual path, which you may be calling religious. In that sense, if religion is a sectarian concept of spirituality, then yes, it very much could be a disturbance. But true religion actually is that essential spirituality that brings our compassion to such a deep place, to the body, to the mind, and also to the true self within others. And that one can have a very value-based moral life without the concept of true religion or true spirituality, and be a good person and be more peaceful and be more pious and everything else. But to actually reach to that depth of our souls and the love of our souls, and to be instruments of that compassion, and to realize ourselves beyond the mortality of these vulnerable little bodies and minds of ours, for that we need a deep spiritual path. I hope that answers your question. So yes, we could be very good people and we can make big difference, but you know, we need to make that transcendental connection. It's important that we have what you may call religion, but not the sectarian conception of it.
What are your views on sort of the sin in the world and about repentance and forgiveness?
There's a lot of sin in the world. Repentance really in its higher form is how we speak and how we live. Because, you know, in certain religious schools, you know, repentance is practiced in various ways. You know, we can torture ourselves for what we've done. We can beg for the pardon of what we've done. There's many ways of repentance. But in our tradition, the real repentance is to stop doing the wrong thing and start doing the right thing. Because if we just, you know, beg for forgiveness, but then we keep doing the same thing, there's not much benefit in that. If we really understand that what we're doing is not right, we change our heart and we change the way we live, and we seek out people who actually can help us change our values, and we make choices. There's a analogy that in every heart there are two dogs. There's a good dog and there's a bad dog. The good dog is barking and calling us to a life of compassion, forgiveness, devotion, honesty, love. The bad dog, envy, arrogance, greed, selfish passion of lust, anger. So these two dogs are in every one of our hearts. Do all of you have that experience? It's the nature of the mind. Sometimes, you know, you have the voice of just such goodness, and other times you just want to take revenge, and you're so angry, and you're so dissatisfied, and you're so agitated, and you're sometimes depressed. That's the bad dog. And those two dogs are fighting within all of us. Which one's going to win? The one that you and me choose to feed. The one we choose to feed is going to get strength. And the one we choose not to feed is going to get weak. And what is that feeding? By the choices we make. Moment to moment in our life, the choices that we make. In this situation, am I going to follow the bad dog by cheating and being dishonest and being greedy and not caring if I cause pain to another for myself? Or am I going to follow the good dog? And there's a higher principle than this, and I know I could be more successful if I'm honest and I live with integrity. Am I going to take this intoxication, or am I going to become sober? These are the bad dogs and the good dogs. They're always within us. And according to which ones we have fed in the past, that's the one that's barking the loudest. And sometimes the bad dog really is barking loud in us. Like that. And sometimes the good dog, pretty soft little voice in the corner of our mind, just begging, feed me. We always have the choice. And true repentance is to feed the good dog, to actually live with integrity, with live with morality, to live with devotion. To live according to a higher principle rather than a lower principle. And whatever methods of repentance we may do, if the result is that we actually commit ourselves with determination and take the help we need from other people, from our spiritual practice and other, and from the choices we make, to make those right choices, then we're actually coming out from what you said, the sin of the world. Does that answer your question? Yes.
Thanks a lot for the sharing. I really treasure the love and values that you shared. But and I agree with you that all the religions, they all share the same values in essence. But now these days, different religions, I feel that they are comparatively much more aggressive in penetrating in different parts of the world, especially those with extreme values. And those values, I think it actually goes against your values. Do you feel being threatened, or do you feel that they are your competitors now?
I think that in every religion, people listen to the bad dog, and in every religion, people listen to the good dog. But the whole purpose of every religion is to listen to the good dog. So I don't see that it is religion that's causing the hatred, the discrimination, the arrogance, the terrorism. It's been there throughout history. It's just a very infatuated ego. You could put it in the name of a religion. You could put it in the name of a nationalistic concept. You could put it in so many different names. You know, and when Hitler and his people were really terrorists. They were murdering millions and millions of innocent people. That wasn't in the name of religion. That was in the name of a political agenda. But look at how much harm. And people have done the same kind of harm in the name of religion too. It's just, we superimpose our own arrogance and insecurity and envy and greed and all these things, we put them in the name of nationalism or political party or religion, whatever it may be. So the competition is not between one religion and another religion. The competition is the good dog and the bad dog that's barking in our hearts and their hearts. And it must be barking in some people, it's really barking and really ruling over and controlling their decisions in life. And causing them to influence others. So the competition is between light and dark, between good and evil, between truth and ignorance. And in whatever form it takes, that's really the competition is. Because there's beautiful, God-loving, compassionate people of every great religion. And actually, we're of one religion, all of us. And there's people who are extremists. You know, I've studied some history, and I found in the history of every religion, Christianity, Judaism, Buddhism, Hinduism, Islam, there's been terrorists in all these different groups, but they're not representing the truths to love God with all your heart, mind, and soul, and to love your neighbor as yourself. The Crusades, oftentimes they didn't represent that, but saints like Francis and Antonio, I go to their places in Italy, they represented that. So in every path, there's been the extremists and there's been the people who were seeking the essence. So the competition isn't one religion against another. The competition is the true core values, those who share that, and those who, due to whatever insecure egos they may have, they just follow the barking of the bad dogs within them. And it all begins actually with making that solution as far as we can within ourselves. Because then we have so much more strength to actually help make a solution in the world. And when scientists and technologists and politicians and business people and farmers and agriculturalists and educators, professors and swamis and monks, when we all come together to share these true spiritual values, then we actually have a lot of strength. Because the best thing that dispels darkness is light. In the world, we oftentimes try to dispel darkness with darkness. But it doesn't work. But to find that light within ourselves, to share it within ourselves, and then to create bigger and bigger light is... That's why I came to India. And I also pray that some inspiration in that way can come, can be appreciated by all of you during your visit to India. From some people's perspective, you've come to study and visit. But many people, when they leave, even with the same purpose, they leave with the idea that I have just been on pilgrimage. Thank you very much.
I can't use words to express our deepest appreciations to the wisdom that has been shared in this room to all of us and to inspire us as future leaders or whoever we want to be, a good dog or a bad dog. That's the life of yours and you make the choice. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much.